Down there resides the sum of all necromantic transgression, she said, in the sing-song way of a child repeating a poem. The unperceivable howl of 10,000 million unfed ghosts who will hear each echoed footstep as defilement. They would not even be satisfied if they tore you apart. The space beyond that door is profoundly haunted in ways I cannot say and by means you won't understand. And you may die by violence, or you may simply lose your soul.
Gideon rolled her eyes so hard that she felt in danger of twisting the optic nerve. Knock it off. We're not in chapel now.
But Harrow said, It's not one of mine, Griddle. I'm repeating exactly, to the word, what teacher said to me.
Teacher said the facility was chocolate with ghosts and you might die?
Correct.
Surprise, my tenebrous overlord, said Gideon. Ghosts and you might die is my middle name.
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, episode 13, Gideon Nav Talking Time.
Oh, this chapter is so satisfying in terms of like pivoting into deeper relationship between our troubled babies.
It's so much more honest.
Yeah. And it like reflects that what happened back on the 9th, where like when Harrow is not performing, when Harrow is not trying to create a certain perception of other people of the 9th, she is often quite frank with Gideon. And goodness knows she doesn't have the energy for bullshit at the moment.
This is such a small detail, but I noticed right at the top of this chapter, blood sweat only comes out of the head.
I'm immediately thinking about, you know, mucous membranes that are in and around the head that are really dense with capillaries super close to the surface in ways that the rest of the body isn't, like the nose, the eyes, the mouth. Where we'll see that, you know, utilized in medical contexts. But at the same time, I'm like, blood sweat might also happen in a vagina.
I was thinking armpits feel like a real...
Armpits?
There's a lot of sweat. There's some pretty thin skin. It makes sense in the moment that what we're being told is she doesn't have any external wounds. It's just the blood sweat. But why isn't her whole body just sort of caked in sort of a rime of dried blood? And maybe it's aesthetic. Maybe Tamsin Muir was like, that's gross. I don't know.
Just like all of her clothes crusty with dried blood, and Gideon's like watching blood flakes off as she's like walking down the hallway.
If I invented this magic system and people sweated blood, it'd be all over. It'd be gross. Nasty.
But like,
you'd have a hard day and your socks would be just ruined.
It's like a particular type of crusty. And it's interesting that like with the blood sweat so far in this book, I haven't really heard of people talking about the smell of blood.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we were portrayed in the last book of like a fair amount of blood. Palamides articulated, you know, the timing of it drying. Like mm-hmm. The idea that the smell of blood is part of it is reasonable, but is not really actually part of the what is usually a fairly thorough sensory description of a scene.
Yeah, because we get a lot of other smells.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm trying to think of anywhere where there's like the smell of blood involved in this book, but I can't actually think of an example. And maybe we'll come across one, but like...
I have a vague memory that maybe we get a taste of blood, like we get a metallic, but... Yeah. But yeah, I'm not recalling. But I will say, if you asked me name all the smells in the book, I wouldn't come up with a lot of examples.
Yeah, I would be like, okay, so the 9th is musty. There's the terrace on Kanan House. Like,
ammonia smells like taking a run.
But yeah, very little talk about. And I'm curious as we get more, you know, in the later books into blood wards and that kind of stuff, if that changes. This is also this emotional intimacy and deepening is wonderfully set up. Harrow is the most exposed to Gideon physically that we have seen so far in the book. Like, yeah. We talked in the earlier chapter that Gideon saw Harrow's neck and it was wild.
Yeah, I was thinking that there was a sort of parallel between this and the library scene where the face painting happens, mm-hmm. where Harrow is, you know, she's without her robe. She's just kind of hanging out. She's much more relaxed and in a state of undress versus how she normally presents to the world. And in that scene also, there's this very matter-of-fact death threat, and we get that in this scene as well, that maybe part of how Harrow manages her feelings of vulnerability are being like, I will fucking kill you.
And, like, I've had a friend like that who's, like, very protective, very prickly, and then there's this... I had an interaction recently with someone where they're like, don't you dare ever fucking take care of me, and I was like, don't worry, I won't, because I'm like, you just expressed a very clear boundary. But it was this, like, similar energy. And, like, Gideon checked for injuries and had been traumatized by the experience. So there's both the vulnerability that Harrow is having to just be, generally choose to be this vulnerable in this position. And Gideon's like, I guess I'm here with you. Oh, God. She's being thorough, but also this is uncomfortable.
I feel like that's such a teenager who's never had sex experience of... Yeah, I feel like when I was a teenager, literally one of the most horrifying things that I could and did imagine all the time was needing to treat someone for hypothermia. I thought about it a lot.
It is really interesting what bodies do when they are aware of proximity, because it's like, it's not a casual thing in the vast majority of contexts. Like, in my line of work, I am in close proximity with other human beings really regularly, but those are children. Mm-hmm. Like, I literally, when I kiss someone for the first time, may throw up. Yeah. Like, like, there's so much less touch as we get older, but also looking at the, like, culture of the ninth, like, there's no tenderness, there's no intimacy. Of course, like, they're all fucking touch starved. And, like, the idea of human contact is, like, this deeply activating thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And they both have such a deep ambivalence toward each other, which is very reasonable. But yeah, that sense of, like, panic at having to be close to Harrow's body.
And, like, I could imagine, you know, Gideon in that moment being, like, very practical, trying to, because when you're in a situation like that, you're like, I'm going to do the task. You're not emotionally really present as you're kind of dealing with this emergency scenario, and then you step back and you're like, ah, that felt fucked up, because you kind of come back into yourself after doing so. You know, that is the place that both of them are at as this conversation started, both of them being like, why are we touching, but both of them clearly recognizing the necessity of it, because what follows is we need to be able to work together. But yeah, I do love that Harrow's like, I'll fucking kill you, as her, like, how dare you perceive me as vulnerable.
So Gideon is bringing an entirely new energy to the situation. We have seen her, like, fuck you, I'm out of here. But this is like, no, I'm in charge now. We're doing a new thing.
I think part of this comes around seeing the relationship between Palamedes and Camilla. She sees what's possible if she actually, like, commits, engages, is present for Harrow. Like, Gideon wants to win. Like, this isn't a competition, but Gideon also wants to win. And she realizes that divided, they have fallen.
I don't even know if it's that as her motivation. The way that I read Gideon is that she just so badly wants to be useful.
Yeah. We have this checking for injuries, but also the glass of water, which is, like, this very specific task that Palamedes, like, he's like, here's the checklist. And in one of the blog posts, you joke about how, like, I perceive Gideon as a top, and how, like, everyone's like, what? Where, you know, if someone's, like, kind of bottomy, they're like, give me a job. I want to do a thing. Tell me what to do. And now she has that.
Well, so I heard a thing once. And it was the shopping cart theory of BDSM. Does the top or the bottom push the shopping cart?
Interesting. That's not what I expected. I expected something more about who's selecting what's being put in the shopping cart, but I, no, yeah.
They're both valid,
Yeah.
but they are different. They're bringing a different energy.
Interesting.
And I think part of why is Gideon a top or a bottom comes up, and how I think, if I'm to get on a little soapbox here, top bottom phrenology discourse is fucking stupid. is that's not how it works.
No, it's much more nuanced than that. People aren't.
But you can have a moment of being assertive and be a bottom, and you can also be entirely devoted to being of service and be a top. Like, those things aren't in contrast with one another.
Yeah, there's so many more layers to that interaction than simply like, I do, you receive. Like, it's actually partly we're seeing in this about need. So like as Harrow's need has pivoted, Gideon's like, okay, I'm taking charge here because like clearly your judgment is deserving of criticism. But I think from earlier on, like Gideon is invested, but I think now you're right, Gideon has something to do. Gideon has a way to express her involvement. She has realized that kind of Harrow's facade of like having it all together is like 50% bullshit. And she can both leverage this to find purpose, but also to like contextualize herself in this situation. Because one of the things that she's been struggling with the last number of chapters is idleness, but also like what the fuck is going on? And this, both of these are addressed in this conversation of like, stop keeping me in the dark. And also stop being a fucking idiot because you're not going to be able to continue this at this way.
We joked about reading this in a power dynamic metaphor, but on a deeper level, Gideon and Harrow are outside the context that enforces their power relationship. And Gideon is freer to resist because Crux isn't there to throw her down a mine shaft.
Yeah, like Gideon is Harrow's extension of physical power now, where before she used others to keep physical power over Gideon.
And Gideon has seen her run out of power just now. And so, on the one hand, she's motivated to speak up and be like, hey, your leadership sucks and you're fucking us both over. But on the other hand, she has an opportunity here politically. Like, she
Yeah.
is seeing this vulnerability and she is exploiting the vulnerability in the sense of she's like, listen, this doesn't serve either of our needs. You need to get your shit together.
Yeah. And I think when I first read this book, when I first cosplayed Gideon, I really oversimplified her in a lot of ways. Like, she can match Harrow's strategic like ambition. She doesn't have the same kind of drive to gather information that Harrow does. So usually she's operating with like information after Harrow has gotten it. But in terms of seeing opportunities, in terms of like trying to push the mission forward, she's a smart girl who's motivated, recognizing that Gideon just as much has to play this political game as Harrow. And she's like, stop playing us against each other. Because them strategizing against each other is weakening their position. And she is not oblivious to that. She has personally experienced the vulnerability that doing so has put her in, and now has directly witnessed the vulnerability that it puts Harrow in. And she's like, that's fucked up and stupid. We're gonna talk about it now.
And I think she's probably a little embarrassed because of the stuff that Calamity said. Like, Camilla never would have left me alone like that.
I think both of them are embarrassed by that experience.
Totally.
Neither of them wanted to be perceived as having any sort of cracks in their stoic, scary ninth house acolyte, blah, 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 blah. Like, but they were treated with such compassion at the through that chapter by the end of it. They were seen in this vulnerability. They were seen in this flawedness. They were given like good advice to try and continue their goals. And it It shifts something.
This really maybe belongs in last episode, but we didn't say it, and it's just on my heart. It was such a fucking good choice that when Camilla threw the key ring to Palamedes, he missed, because they could have gone through that chapter looking like absolute Marvel superheroes. And she was like, no, they're just like really skilled people. Like, don't, like, they're not, they're just some guys who like really have their shit together.
But also recognize that like they have vulnerabilities in this scenario as well.
I love that they didn't handle it perfectly. I love that they were a little bit snippy with each other. Like, they were really a powerful counterexample, but they weren't perfect.
Yeah, and in recognizing that there can be this contentiousness in the relationship, there can be this like poking at each other thing while still also very strongly upholding each other's efforts. You can let them in. It cannot be clean. It can be actually kind of uncomfortable and messy, and you can keep going forward together. And people can perceive it, and you can keep going forward together.
Yeah, there's trust and there's disapproval, and they make different judgments, and there's enough latitude in their relationship to both trust each other's judgments and correct each other.
Yeah.
And the correction that we saw, of course, from Palamedes was very different from the corrections that we saw previously from other houses.
Yeah. And as someone who loves Paul, re-exploring this relationship and seeing the way that they interact with each other as eventual constructions of who Paul is internally is interesting to me.
That's funny. I came off of our last episode and had a bunch of like Pyrrha cam feelings.
Fear.
Gideon has seen several different models up close now of what a Cavalier and Necro relationship can look like. And I don't know that she is eager about any of them exactly, but she's getting real impatient with what she's being offered.
Yeah, absolutely. And as like they're exploring, you know, Gideon's pressing and they're exploring this conversation, Hera articulates that like we bring up the sixth and then we also bring up the third. So, you know, talking about those different Cav-Necro relationships is part of what they're kind of acknowledging is part of the meta. Like they're currently negotiating a new Cav-Necro relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And those other models are coming up there.
Yeah.
Their experiences with the other people, they're like, we have to contextualize ourselves within the actual people who are here. They don't say this explicitly, but like if they're sticking to the Cav-Necro relationship that they left the ninth with, they're actually going to stay behind. Like mm-hmm. it's, they're like, these are all these other people doing things in different ways. And like, we can't keep using the same strategy.
I think in the same vein, one of the things that Gideon is really pressing up against here in this scene is Harrow's coping strategy of pretending everything's fine, pretending everything is under control, even when it's not. And that is the way that she has managed her planet since she was 10, is make it look good enough and don't get caught.
Yeah. And you know, that challenged and grew her necromantic ability. But now we're in a situation where the greatest of the greatest necromancers spent enormous amounts of time and focus and resources extending themselves to do the most transgressive levels of necromancy. Like, she does not yet have the skill to pretend that she's got this together. She's actually just not there. She can't. When, you know, she's on the ninth and she can kind of keep pilgrims away and she can kind of keep people from looking too close. She's got that, sure. But like, this is actually like, this is big game, sweetie. Like, you actually can't do this on your own. The necromancers who laid the foundations for where you are now were more advanced than you. Don't get me wrong. You are a prodigious war crime, but like, you can't do this by yourself. It wasn't designed for you to do it by yourself. It was literally designed to be done in partnership with a Cavalier.
We get the first little fight about Dulcinea. Harrow does not like, but she's dallying.
And there's also this, like, it's not quite jealousy, but it is catty. There's a cattiness to it, I think.
She's also not wrong, though.
Yeah, and so, you know, this is maybe one of our first hints that Dulcinea's behavior doesn't make sense.
I think it's ambiguous later. You know, Harrow kind of claims that she was suspicious right off the bat, and it's not clear exactly what that comes to or whether it was just jealousy because Gideon was so interested. But yeah, we see this. You know, she says she picked an interesting place to die. And that does signal the suspicion. You know, that's not just jealousy, but I think it's also not jealousy.
Yeah, it is a kind of, it's a criticism where she's like, is she really in this? Like, is she really like on board with this? Like, why is she here?
But also, and this is so masterful of Tamsin Muir to do this to us. She sets us up so perfectly to be like, ugh, Harrow, you don't know. She would pick an interesting place to die. She told us a story about wanting to pick an interesting place to die. You're just being a bitch. But like, she's not wrong, though.
She's not wrong because, like, this is an extraordinary event, and to send someone who may be not be able to follow through because she's so fragile, like, is not strategic of her house. Like, it's like similarly to how, you know, Hera was like, Ordis is not an option. Like, as the Necro, she's like looking at this as how do we get the best chance of success? She can look at Dulcinea and be like, this was the wrong person to, like, this is why
Only the heirs were invited. They were invited by name. And maybe the seventh doesn't need anything out of this. Maybe it's all the same to the seventh if Dulcinea dies here or at home. Because if she's dying anyway, like, what do they care?
Yeah, and like in reality, in the context, like the seventh did decide to send Dulcinea. Like,
Yeah.
sure. She didn't make it, but they
Yeah.
did make that decision, which like either they're not as concerned about a succession crisis, or somehow they're like totally on board with like, yeah, she's gonna pick a beautiful, like poetic place to die, just like she'd want to.
Well, I think they don't need to be concerned about a succession crisis because she was already dying.
Yeah,
They
they
already
already
have
had a plan in
a
place.
plan. Yeah. I don't
Yeah,
know what it
they're like,
is,
she can go
but
and
she already wasn't coming back.
Yeah. And, you know, Kithareya uses that as a very effective kind of cover, but it smells weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it's reasonable for a person to be like, why would you have chosen that?
Yeah.
But yeah, I do, like I said, I really appreciate that we're so teed up as readers to just completely dismiss this and to write Harrow off when, in fact, yeah, reasonable.
It's a reasonable question. Yeah. So as Harrow starts to like actually engage with Gideon, she still has to reassert her power in doing so. She's like asking these questions, and Gideon's like, come on, like a great line. You're not very good at I'm asking the questions now, bitch, are you? Great line.
There's so many good lines in this chapter. This chapter is delightful.
But Harrow uses this to reestablish her authority as best she can, as the person who has the information. She's like, if I have to share this with you, I'm at least going to do it my way.
Yeah, she's like, no, we're doing Socratic method. I get to be in the driver's seat. Which I do want to draw attention. Harrow says, what did the priest specify was the only rule the first day we were here? There was not one rule.
There were other rules.
There were, I would say there were three rules. No communications,
Right.
which didn't matter to Harrow because she had no one to talk to. And part of that, you know, you can't leave the first until we send you home.
Sure. Yep.
You can use any room that is not assigned to another house. And don't go through a locked door without permission. And Harrow has narrowed that into one rule. Which I just think is really interesting. She doesn't perceive the other ones as relevant, but she does use other rooms. She is off in the library. She is making use of that rule. It's not that both of them were irrelevant to her because she's just a hermit.
Yeah, I mean, the first one, obviously, she's like, she's got no one to talk to. She's not even registering that as a rule. She's like, this is irrelevant. I don't even care. The second one, that's where we start seeing that, like, conscious editing.
Mm-hmm.
This, to me, fits Harrow's personality in the sense of, like, she'll assess a situation and then she'll give it her view. Like, she's like, this is what this looks like according to my priorities.
Yeah, she takes in all the evidence and then she discards anything that isn't relevant to
Yes.
her.
Yes. Which I think is a bit short-sighted because it is an interesting question as why no communications with the outside? Because it gives you implications about the larger environment that this is all happening within. That I think if Harrow had a greater understanding of, she might be approaching this differently. Like if Harrow knew what was going to happen later on down the road and understood that this isolation was about control in a way that is far more intentional than simply some sort of ritualistic isolation, but implicative of a larger political strategy, she'd want to be involved in the responding to an actual political strategy.
But coming from the anchorite's house, she's like, yeah, checks out. That's how people act.
So she's actually missing some details here because of what she thinks is relevant and what is not relevant. And if we apply that to the second rule of like not using rooms that are assigned to someone else, that's also a little bit interesting, but I don't know exactly how. Like it's the idea that there is also some kind of clue hidden in that seems, because nothing teacher says is like singular. It's nothing is like, there's always layers to everything teacher has been saying. And that, you know, only use the rooms assigned to you, like they're controlling their communication, they're controlling their movement.
I kind of wonder what motivated the framing of that rule, why they thought it was necessary to communicate that specifically, because obviously the third and the ninth are imagining that this is a competition. And so in that frame, it makes sense to be told, like, you may not spawn camp the other children. But that's not how teacher is imagining it. And so it seems like the thing he's doing is use whatever you want other than bothering each other, obviously. But is it? You know? I don't know.
And looking at how crafted teacher is and how much what he says is part of commenting on a larger awareness than our narrators have. That this is an exception, then this is just a basic rule of like, don't spawn camp the other children. It would be an exception. I don't know what lies underneath that. Locked doors without permission. So we have this hatch that it was locked, and Harrow has spoken to teacher about it. Was that her soliciting permission? Like locked doors and permission. Permission is really not very clear here.
Yeah, it seems like based on, you know, these various secondhand conversations, she went and asked permission to enter them, and he provided access to the hatch on condition that she could provide a safe place for the key. Wink, 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 wink. You have to put it on the key ring, which, why? Who cares? But whatever. But that he couldn't provide permission to the lab. So it seems like that's the process of getting the hatch key. And I think we get information about the fourth getting a key, but Abigail has it or something like that, where similarly, everybody gets the first key just by asking for permission. And that is kind of the like step into the puzzle.
And once Harrow starts disclosing, once she starts opening up to Gideon, we have another indication of A, Gideon's intelligence, but also like Harrow's awareness of Gideon's intelligence. Like Harrow has partially been keeping Gideon in the dark because maybe she understood just how much Gideon might think and process and get involved. They don't have a historically collaborative relationship, but as soon as she's like, there's no, this is like, hello, autistic person, tell me about your special interests. And she's like, whoof, big book on the table. Like, she immediately starts going into really high detail.
Speaking of books and special interests,
What?
human leather doesn't work like that.
Say more.
So, In the text, it says the awful orange tone of tanned human leather. And what I have written in the margin is, you wish. Because there are books made of tanned human leather. We
Yes.
don't know how many there are because they are fully indistinguishable from other kinds of leather. We test them molecularly to find out that they are definitely human, unless they are known to be human because we know their provenance. The only way to know that a book is leather is by testing its DNA, basically. Any leather book could be a human leather book. You just don't know, but probably it isn't. There's not very many of them.
Okay, I'm going to take this somewhere a little touchy.
Okay.
Let's talk about melanin, vitiligo, and other like things that we use to recognize people's skin as individual.
Mm-hmm.
Not like, so I'm thinking of, you know, we have books that have pelts, so they have fur still remaining.
Mm-hmm.
We have distribution of hair follicles mm-hmm. that may or may not give some indication of what species that leather comes from. In the history of slavery, some incredible things were done from the bodies of Black people.
Yes.
Like, you know, pillows stuffed with hair, literal cannibalism. And so unfortunately, what came to mind is like,
you are correct.
Someone with very melanated skin is going to have a visually distinct, I'm going to say this, even though the sentence feels really gross to say, a book made from a slave's skin is going to be very deeply melanated.
Well, not necessarily.
Okay.
Because people have lots of different skin tones.
Yep.
The relationship between human leather and slavery exists.
Yeah.
My understanding is that the largest proportion of human-bound books specifically is a criminal justice system pathway where
I don't understand.
Court records regarding somebody who was to be executed would then be bound with the person.
So to make sure I understand you, the examples of this that we have confirmed have been through finding books that are associated with an individual, molecularly testing that to confirm that it is a person, and then contextualizing it to see that there was a tradition of combining someone's skin with their judicial records.
No, there are cases where the provenance of the book was already known.
Right.
Because it was immediately after the execution bound with their skin. The molecular ones are the surprises.
The molecular ones are the surprises. Okay.
Yeah. This isn't common. Very few known examples of this exist.
Mm-hmm.
It's enough that it for sure was a practice.
Right. To clarify with what I talked about earlier in terms of usage of body parts as a relationship to slavery, is there any relationship there, or is this part of a different kind of historical context?
I believe that there is a relationship there. I will check and make sure that the stuff that goes in the notes speaks on that.
Fucking. All right, back to the book. I want to talk about something entirely different that I quite enjoyed about this chapter, which is Harrow's accessibility modifications using necromancy.
Yeah.
When she like uses bone chips to like, bed goes up. The amount of accessibility through necromancy that these books portray is so fascinating to me. Is this approach a Ninth House cultural thing? Later on, with what happens for Ianthe's arm, like again, this is coming from the Ninth House. Is accommodations via necromancy a Ninth House thing? Or is this like, I had someone recently message me about Nibirius
mm-hmm.
and Nibirius's height and the necromancy of the third. And like, the third would not be above cosmetic necromancy, or
what would the word be?
Athletically competitive necromancy. Basically, like, did we stretch out Nibirius to make him better at swords? And at what point do you say, okay, that's enough? Does this have to do with the body's capacity to receive this kind of modification? Does this have to do, like, what are the guidelines that like accommodations for necromancy. Okay, great. Bone chips, bed goes up. Now this tired body can be more engaged in this conversation. But if we're talking about Nibiria's turn, we're talking about a house that perception matters a lot. And we know at this point they are using that necromancy, the Anthe is using the necromancy to really uphold quite a facade. And like, I can only assume that all three of them are kind of in on it. So like Ianthe and Coronabeth's feelings about Nibirius's body, he is a tool to them. He is honestly, I think, barely a person to them. You know, his comfort is not actually the priority in evaluating how far they might take that.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And that is especially interesting in conversation with the eugenic programs on the 8th and the 6th. Because it's different kinds of eugenics.
Yeah.
People feel different ways about different kinds of eugenics. And at least in recent decades in the US, enhancement is one of the most offensive ones.
Now, I want to take a second here to quickly just like talk about eugenics. Because I had a conversation recently with someone and someone's like, what's
Is
that?
It my birthday?
I was walking through a part of my city where a lot of unhoused people are. And someone that I was walking with made a comment of like, it makes them feel better about themselves. And I was like, let's talk about eugenics, because I'm going to challenge you on that one. We live in a system that has determined that some people are worthy of living and some people are not, because this person was talking in that moment about things that had happened that had put them in very vulnerable scenarios. And they weren't sure, but they had trust in this social system to take care of them. I live in a country that has a social network of some degree, but it is also informed by a system that determines that some lives are worthy and some are not. And so if you're not familiar with eugenics, it is, correct me if this is misrepresenting it, but as a layman, it is a moral ideology that says some lives are worth and some lives are not, and the ones that are not should die. And we are going to bake these morals into our policies at the government level, at the medical level, at the religious level, that some people are worthy and some people are not.
I think that's a serviceable definition. I'm currently doing my dissertation on the difficulty that people have around defining eugenics. So you just attempted something that's literally impossible. No one else has got it right either. It's totally fine.
I do love attempting things that are nearly impossible that people just don't do. It's one of my favorites. But yeah, so in you know, Mbembe's necropolitics, like, I know that it's been a really core volume in terms of your interpretation of this story, but also in terms of informing some of the underlying political perspectives of eugenics for you in your work.
Totally. So yeah, I think one of the areas of eugenics that is least acknowledged and least visible to people is, some people are just going to die and that's fine. And I think that since 2020, that has started to get public attention, probably really for the first time, with the exception of debates about eugenic negligent infanticide, which has come up before. But the idea that like there are large numbers of adults who should just be like let die has really only started to become controversial recently, in at least my cultural context. And yeah, for me, Mbembe is a big sort of light in that direction of being able to pay attention to that, and also to see it not as passive, because some people really want to frame letting someone die as a passive thing, as not doing something, when often there is an active process of deciding to build that choice in and deciding to make that choice. And technically inaction is part of it, but it's not like, I didn't go to the park today. I didn't decide not to go to the park today. I just didn't go to a park, and I could have, but like I didn't. But like, I didn't let my cat out, you know? It's different. I made choices to not let my cat out. I did that on purpose. I just happened to not go to the park. And eugenic letting die is active.
So I live in a city that has real struggle with housing, as many people do at this point. I have more space than I personally need. And I think the fact that it's normal for people to have housing that is not like being used while people are like, this is a thing that I on the daily grapple with, where it's like, I have a home and there are two beds in my home and one person lives here. And that is fucked up. And there are multiple people in my building who could claim that. Multiple people in my neighborhood could claim that. It's not a big number, but like, I've looked at the math for my city. We could have everyone housed. Why the fuck is anyone sleeping on the street?
Yeah.
And so like, I see my own inaction as an extension of this normalization of being like, oh, I recognize it, but what can I do? Mm. Like, feels bad. And it should, in my opinion. It should not feel okay at all, because the outcomes are the intentional outcomes of pro-eugenics policies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this stuff isn't by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing that people haven't really realized, is that this, none of this is by accident.
A lot of my time is spent on widening the scope of what people recognize as being linked to eugenics, because it sounds completely unbelievable if you grew up in the 90s or the 80s or the 2000s, like around then, and that sort of moment of literature was sort of moving from eugenics as something that specifically Nazis did to actually, at least like largely in the United States, we moved from thinking about eugenics in terms of Nazis specifically to thinking about United States eugenics. And the US had the earliest and in many ways the biggest, the most expansive eugenics program. Eugenics was built into the American government at the federal, state, municipal, and organizational levels, all the way from individual clergy who refused to marry couples who didn't have a eugenic health certificate, all the way up to the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture was a eugenicist for many years. And if you understand eugenics in terms of Nazis and forced sterilization, that doesn't even make sense.
Mm-hmm.
What's agriculture got to do with it?
Yeah, I use the example of redlining to try and illustrate how like racism isn't like, it's not defined by like slavery anymore. It is defined and practiced and applied in policy.
Mm-hmm.
In strategic policy that have long reaching impact. And that is an extension of eugenics. Some people deserve to have safe housing and some people don't.
Alexandra Minna-Stern wrote a book about eugenics in California recently. And part of what it does is look at the eugenic roots of the Save the Redwoods Project. Save the Redwoods is explicitly racist because it's a superior race of tree that's being choked out by inferiors that shouldn't be there. It's a metaphor for white people. And like, we should save the redwoods. Like, redwoods are great.
This is bringing up for me a lot of parallels to the like, let's plant trees in Israel. You know, cedars across Israel. Like, actually, we're erasing the pre-existing ecology that was developed in partnership with Palestinians who have lived there for ever. Left grief.
We've gotten so far off of this chapter.
Let's get back into the text.
Let's get back into the text.
That was like accessibility through necromancy. Then we're like, but what is eugenics? But I think the thing to like underline here is recognizing that what is acceptable and appropriate applications of necromancy are culturally contextualized to each house.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can look at their motivation, aversion, choices around how they apply their necromancy as like part of how they've been raised to normalize this. And it is not the same between each of these communities. What if we talked about architecture? We get into architecture and then like Mir is like, okay, dad joke, let's go.
Oh, with the multiple levels and the rigor mortis.
And so it's this interesting thing where now they, in their conversation, there's levity. There's now play.
Yeah. You were mentioning in a previous episode that there's this shift in when somebody's going through a really heavy conversation and they like start making jokes, they're sort of coming out of that
Yeah.
depth. And yeah, it seems like that's really happening here. That
It's
they're still mad at each other and they're still really like in the fight, but they are also playing a little bit.
Gideon is realizing that Harold is giving. Harold wants Gideon to be paying attention and not like making jokes because she's like on. But Gideon's like, man, I'm funny. And I think the joke is funny. I was looking through old TikToks recently, and there's a TikTok between Han and I where it's just me reacting to something Han is saying, and I'm like, I hate what you're about. Like, I love you, but I hate what you're about to say. And I wasn't sure what was going to happen because I haven't seen this in years. And it was immediately followed by you being like, puns are just training. What? Oh, fuck. How is it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
Puns are training for being mad.
puns are training for being mad. And I was so mad that you said that. I was like, I love puns. Shut up.
No, I
Which
do
almost
too.
like kind of validates your point.
Yeah.
Like, everybody's mad. Either you don't appreciate the pun and I'm mad about it, or you do appreciate the pun and like everyone else is mad.
Yeah.
Great, great dad jokes there, Gideon. I'm in your corner.
Yeah, my marginalia is just a series of little hearts.
Yeah, and so they start getting into it. They look at this diagram. Harrow is explaining her methods here in as much detail as she thinks is relevant, which is a fair amount of detail because she really wants Gideon to actually like get it. There's so much strategic thinking as just like, you're like, okay, what's the information? What are the resources? How can I, like, it's an approach. It's a habit.
She knows that Sextus is trying to figure out the dating, but she thinks that that's stupid.
Another example of Harrow being like, this information is not relevant. I don't care. It's dumb. While like Palamedes is like, something is fucking weird here.
Yeah.
In a way that, again, with the first and second rules, Harrow's like, that's stupid, not relevant. And we're looking at it, we're like, no, this is saying something about the larger situation that Harrow has missed.
She wants to focus on the function, and she appreciates that Gideon's question about that is who used this space, because that tells you a lot about how it was used and why it existed and what.
So these are labs. They were doing tests in this to try and develop necromantic theorems to achieve lictorhood. The swapping from test to challenge is interesting because we go from lab, which is like experimentation, development of ideas, development of technology. Tests overlap that. We're doing testing. But now tests also overlap with challenge. Challenge is something set up by one person for another person. So we have like this kind of timeline of how these spaces have actually evolved in their use, illustrated by like the way that Harrow is kind of shifting the language. The idea that the original lictors left behind something specific as extensions of their research, but as gatekeeping to the knowledge, paints a picture of some kind of anticipation. I'm a little surprised that Harrow isn't recognizing that here, but maybe she's like you. She's not in a position where she would really think that questioning the fundamental design of the system that she's operating in is part of the relevant examination. Like,
Yeah.
but she sees it.
Do you think the skull is a cow?
Animal skull, long horns, horns curved in with points almost touch, but not quite. No. I mean, okay. I, having grown up in Canada, have a picture of a cow in my mind. That is a specific cow breed. There are many throughout the entire world that have many different types of horns. So, like, my vivid vision of cow doesn't do that. But I would more think of like goats and wildebeest that have their horns bringing closer into the center. But, like, my frame of reference of cow and Mir's frame of reference of cow might be different.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about the almost touching is that you're looking at something, they're curving inward, which to me says in towards the skull. So either you have something that has a seasonal shedding of horn, or you have something that has been bred to this. This is not a something that curves inward that is ongoing growing is going to pose a health risk to that animal. Mm-hmm. So either this trait has been bred in, or there is some kind of natural process that prevents this from doing harm to the animal. I think it's more likely this is a very specifically bred animal.
Mm.
So maybe it's a cow, but I don't think it's by accident that its horns are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's almost more interesting to me, whatever species it is. Why this animal? Why this modification? Why this extremeness?
Yeah. I think that the animal skull with the long horns is at the, it's near the door with the circles and lines symbol that we mm-hmm. were puzzled about.
Yeah.
I have heard it suggest that that is an Aries constellation. It has the right number of circles. So it might be a ram that goes with the Aries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wait, I thought that was Capricorn. I don't know a lot about astrology, though.
I don't either.
Okay. But I do think that's a really solid theory.
Gideon has found something that Harrow has not. And
yes.
She says, way ahead of you. After Harrow was like, do you know how hard it is to stay ahead of Palamity Sextus?
The satisfaction, like, it does, it kind of like glosses, like, it says just thoroughly satisfied. Like, there's like three or four words describing Gideon's like delight in being able to do this.
She's
but like
so pleased
she's so pleased she's been waiting her whole fucking life to be like, look, Nana Jesmus, you didn't even notice, you need me.
Yeah, she's like, I actually know secret shit that you don't even know. How about that
And
I love this for her. I'm so pleased.
And yeah, it doesn't actually take much time to explore either of their reactions to this, though we can absolutely assume that Harrow is like really frustrated at this shift in dynamic. She was the one giving all this information. She was the one kind of leading the conversation. And now Gideon's like, well, actually.
Oh, let me just correct your notes really quick.
But Harrow is very, very motivated by information.
Totally.
She's willing to gloss that over because this is getting them closer to where they want to be. So like, her pride is not actually her most important priority, getting the thing done. She's very goal driven.
And again, Gideon is really tactically smart because she slaps down this information, she rubs it in, and then she immediately pivots towards like, hey, you need to start taking me seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, she changes the power dynamic and then uses it to continue her, like, reinforcing that this is a different environment.
Mm-hmm.
We're not on the ninth.
Mm-hmm.
And Harrow's like, fucking kill me then.
Yeah, I thought it was so interesting that this is a perpendicular threat to the one that she usually makes. Usually,
yeah.
Like, I'll kill you. I'll kill you. I'll just kill you. And she's like, oh, what are you going to do? Kill me? Like, have you thought that maybe there's another way to interact with another human being other than murder?
And like, Gideon continues pressing. Gideon Nav talking time.
So she... satisfying. This is such a satisfying scene, having come through this 150 pages, watching Gideon emotionally and physically get her ass kicked. It's so good to see her just be like, no, shut up.
Yeah, we're like, yeah, good, 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 good. I am your creature, gloom mistress. I serve you with fidelity as big as the mountain, penumbral lady. I am your sworn sword, night boss.
I love the performance.
And like, at this point, like, death threats are, she's like, doesn't even have it in her.
No, she threatens to enjoy it.
Wait. Harrow threatens to enjoy it, or Gideon does? Where am I looking?
A couple more lines down. And you'd better stop it with all this Twilight Princess garbage, said Harrow, because I may start to enjoy it, which is an extremely Iante move. She takes Gideon's bid, but she's like, you better stop flirting with me.
Which to me speaks of how she can pivot in a situation. She's like, okay, threatening to kill you no longer works. I'm going to threaten to enjoy your attention, which will make you feel weird and gross. So go fuck yourself.
Maybe it's just honest.
I mean, we have been talking about how Hera is generally very frank and transparent with Gideon when she's not performing for other people.
And we know from the inside that all Gideon wants, in fact, is Hera's genuine approval and attention. And that's also a thing that Hera's not getting from Gideon.
It's also interesting because, like, has there been anywhere else in this book so far where Hera has enjoyed anything besides tormenting Gideon, obviously?
No, I mean, and she even really made a show of not enjoying tormenting Gideon.
No. And so if we're going with the, this is a, you know, earnest conversation between them, this is a whole new part of Hera we've never heard of. Maybe she likes Gideon shouting at her a little bit. This lends to my Gideon is a top theory.
I will say, I'm not sold on Gideon as a top, but I am sold on Hera as a bottom.
Fair enough.
I personally think they're both bottoms, and that's part of their problem.
And then we get to this recitation from her conversation with teacher. So down there resides the sum of all necromantic transgression. I'm like, isn't the planet Earth ghost down there? Because that's like 10,000 million unfed ghosts. Because to me, this sounds like a resurrection beast. And this is obviously, you know, teacher's understanding of what's down there.
So what, this is going to seem silly, but the thing that I got totally hung up on in this paragraph was teacher doesn't have a word for billion, which makes sense because billion doesn't really come into broad use in English until about the 1950s, when people become aware for the first time that the global population is over 2 billion. Until there is either a billion people or $1 billion or a billion of something, people don't need that word. And that gives us a very strong cap on the universe population.
I feel like I learned the number Googleplex before I learned the number billion.
That one's a really fun one to say.
It is so fun. Check out the etymology of the word Google, y'all. Googleplex is one followed by a Google number of zeros. But yeah, like, so do you think that that sets teacher's knowledge within that time context? Like, do you think this dates teacher's development?
I think that the word billion just isn't in use. And I think that there aren't a billion people.
So the population has gone down so dramatically that that word has fallen out of use.
That's how I read this.
And so they no longer have that word, but at the time of these ghosts being alive, there was that many.
Mm-hmm.
So it has been long enough since all of those people died that this word just doesn't exist anymore.
That's how I read it.
It gives us another piece about the larger world that they're in. Like the sum population of all the houses and the colonies is smaller than the current population of Earth.
I think very significantly smaller. Yeah,
yeah, significantly smaller. Yeah, interesting. Also, this indicates to us that Hera can very easily memorize what people have said once. And precisely.
Yeah.
She has that kind of memory.
And she repeated it in a particular intonation as well, which might have been also a mimic of the intonation.
Either a mimic of the intonation or a mnemonic device.
Mm-hmm.
Because creating things into rhythm, into sing-songy patterns helps establish more parts of your brain involved in remembering the thing.
Yeah, true.
And given that, you know, a lot of her memorization would have been involved in prayers, which are often encoded with kind of rhythm and song, her kind of just doing that to things that she's like, I'm going to remember this. Do-do-do-do-do-do. And she like, to me, the idea that like Hera hears something and then makes a little song about it in her head is so charming.
You're absolutely devoted to making Hera cute.
Look, I love neurotic little goblins, okay? I am Scorpia. I am Rose Quartz. I love them. I think they are adorable.
So the last thing in this chapter that I have annotated, I annotated a lot this chapter. was, "You may die by violence or you may simply lose your soul." Immediately next to this, I have written in all caps, "Ugh." And then down at the bottom, I have added, "Which of them loses her soul?"
I mean, technically, she didn't lose it. Like, she knows where it is.
But great question.
This maybe is similar to how I was talking about the word test, where, like, soul in some ways in this talks about maybe moral integrity, or soul may be a very concrete material within necromancy. We are not clear whether the use of soul as a stand-in for the concept of moral integrity is still in use with the word soul. But I imagine Muir is offering us that as readers. I think Gideon loses her soul, but Hera loses herself.
And Gideon, once again picking up Harrow's worst habits, fails to make contact with that part of the message. She's like, "Cool, I might die."
No probs.
Heard.
And honestly, beyond that, of like, yeah, let's go. Like, not even just like kind of doesn't make connect with being like, this is actually very motivating. Ghosts and You Might Die is my middle name. When Gideon says this, is she thinking about her own death or Hera's?
Gideon is always thinking about both.
And we return to the both and
Both and.
conclusion. Both and.
I think mostly her own. But I also, I don't, you know, as we've discussed before, I don't know how seriously Gideon takes the concept of her own death. I don't think
Yeah.
that she has a conscious awareness that she can't die.
Yeah.
But I think that she doesn't have a normal relationship with risk assessment.
Relatable. Yeah. This is not a thing that's going to be a flag for her. She's like, eh, sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Cracks kick me down a mine shaft. Whatever. Fuck it. And goodness knows, threatening death upon each other is turning into a form of affection between these two.
Yeah. And having been threatened with Hera having a good time, Gideon does go ahead and keep using the nicknames.
I don't think I ever saw the word tenebris or tenebris. Where's the emphasis?
I've only seen it written, I think, tenebris, but I'm not confident.
Okay.
It's a good word.
I'm gonna do a little etymology searching on this one, because I want to know a bit more about the, because there will be rules that determine where that stress point is, and I want to know them.
I really like Edom Online, but I also do Wiktionary a lot.
I'm more of a girly who looks at like root components, and I'm like, okay, what language does this come from? What language does this come from? Like, I was raised with binomial like Latin and Greek naming as part of how I learned to identify things in the world because my parents are fucking nerds. My mom's a biologist, and so like I learned. Like, there's a plant called horsetail commonly, but I learned it as Equisetum canadensis. And so, for me, learning about the rules that these little pieces each follow, like, you can look at the discourse about how to pluralize octopus and play with these games. So, I want
Octopodes.
to. Yeah, Octopodes, obviously. Octopodes. Gideon's a big dweeb because, like, playing with language is such a nerdy game in a way of showing affection.
So we haven't actually mentioned this on the show because I forgot that how podcasts work. But in the show notes of each episode, we have recommended readings that connect to what we've been discussing. And sometimes it's specific things that we've referenced. And sometimes it's just additional things that, like, if you got curious about a particular thing that we got dug into, there's more stuff to follow that thread. And sometimes there's more stuff and sometimes there's less stuff, but there's usually, you know, around five or six things that you can go chase a fun little rabbit hole with. So yeah, if you haven't been checking out the show notes, check out the show notes and check out our cover art for each week.
And also check out the really awesome blog posts that Han has made so far.
There's like two. It's not that. It's not even a big
They're
deal.
both rad as hell. And some and like worth checking out.
Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is Claire. You can find us online at nunpod.com or get our attention online with the hashtag nunpod. Thanks for listening.